the devil's work and his strategies and the way that he operates, as we came across the passage in 1 Peter 5, where it says that he goes about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. And part of that way that he devours, of course, is trying to find a true Christian, or at least one who professes to be, and devour them by getting them to deny the faith, to play the part of the coward, and in the face of persecution, death, torture, or whatever it may be that he applies to them, that they would recant, would renege upon their covenant with Jesus Christ, that they would bring reproach upon Jesus Christ, even if it be temporarily, like Peter did. Peter was elect. He did persevere to the end. He was recovered and restored. But it was to his shame that he denied Jesus three times. And so the Satan goes about prowling around like a hunter, like a roaring lion with an appetite, seeking someone to devour. He doesn't have to spend a lot of time on unbelievers because they already do his will. He already holds them captive. He already has them utterly duped and blinded, and they don't know which way's up. And though they don't know that they're doing his will, they are in fact doing his will. They are like puppets in his hand. He merely puts his hand up the back sleeve and he makes them say and do whatever he wants them to do. We never see in the New Testament that anyone possessed by a demon is able to deliver themselves. They simply are not strong enough. They're not able to speak to the demon within them and cast them out. Their only hope is that Jesus Christ would come upon them and have mercy upon them and cast the demon out. And then they are clothed and in their right mind. But if Jesus Christ has not come, they're hopeless. They're out of luck, so to speak. This morning I want to look at John chapter 8, verses 44 through 47, and deal with Satan's lies, particularly as it applies to education and to some degree in government. We have looked at how he attacks the church and how he sends false prophets into the church to try to corrupt the church and to try to corrupt the people who attend church through the false prophet. My premise is from this passage that Satan, being a father of lies, that he lies continually, and that even when he tells the truth, it's to get to only couch it in such a way so that you will think wrongly about something, so that you will draw the wrong conclusion from it. He may tell a truth, but he's so shrunk down the amount of truth that you've heard that it leads you to the wrong conclusion, whereas you would have a very different conclusion if you heard all of the story and all of the truth. It's simply common sense, and I believe the devil has common sense, but it's simply common sense that if you're the evil one and you can't be everywhere at once like God can be, okay, there's no indication in Scripture that the devil is omnipresent, that he's in China right now and he's in America and he's in New York City and he's in San Francisco and he's in Seneca. There's no indicator that the devil is everywhere at once, and yet, so he operates by extension through his forces of darkness, which are demons. Now, there's a finite number of them. I don't know how many there are. I don't know if there's as many demons as there are people in this world, but I kind of have my doubts. And even if there were, it is simply logical and common sense. It simply makes good sense if you are the evil one, or if you're anyone, and you want to have a dramatic universal influence, that you would get control of the sources of information. One source of information for the people is the church. That's where they're hopefully going to get the truth. And if you can frustrate that, if you can get into the pulpit, then you can frustrate the entire congregation. Because they depend upon truth coming from the pulpit to be instructed and educated on what the Bible actually means and what God actually says. And if you can corrupt the pulpit, you can corrupt the people who are listening to the guy in the pulpit. Furthermore, there are other information sources in this country. Another one is the media. If you can get into the media and you can corrupt the media, the news anchors, the people on television, the newspapers, the magazines, and so forth, then the people who pick up those publications or who tune in or who go on the internet to get their news and are dependent upon other people doing the research and doing their homework and then giving to you what is supposed to be the truth, then you can corrupt all sorts of people because they're dependent upon these people to do their homework for them. Nobody has time to go out and dig through all this stuff and find out what's really the case, to find out what the real truth is. So they're dependent upon the information sources to get it to them straight. And if the devil can get a hold of those places and corrupt those, he's got it made. It's easy. As I used the illustration last week, you don't have to go into everyone's home and poison their individual glass of wine. Just simply poison the barrel. You don't have to poison everyone's water glass. Just go to the community well and pour your poison in there. Everyone will drink of it because that's where they go. And furthermore, our education system is a source of information. It's where we're supposed to learn things, hopefully truth. And if the devil can get a hold of the education system and speak lies through the education system, he's got it made. It just makes common sense. The devil's not an idiot. He's not stupid. He knows what works better than we do. And so if he were smart, he would go into the schools and deceive there. Go to the publishers of textbooks and deceive them. And that way the books that you get, that you're going to study, that you depend upon to contain factual information, doesn't. But you think it does. Or you go to the school board members and you corrupt them so that they, who then have decisions over the local school district, that they will make decisions according to their own corruptness. Now, let me insert a caveat. I'm making no accusations against the local school board or anything, or this local school. I don't have that kind of intimate knowledge of the teachers, the school board, or anything. I'm just saying education in general, from the bottom up, from preschool to kindergarten and on up to college and seminary. We talked about seminary already. At every level, all Satan has to do is to deceive those who control the information, and then he can thereby more easily deceive the masses without having to assign a demon to every single person. Now, with respect to homeschooling, he can deceive them too. Homeschooling is no sure bet that you won't be deceived. Because to the degree that a homeschooler uses information given to them by one who is deceived, they themselves will be deceived. So again, Satan will use the same approach. Find the teachers. Find the people who are publishing. Find the authors. Find the textbook people and deceive them, and then you can deceive the whole lot of them. In John 8, 44-47, it says, "You are of your father the devil," speaking to Jews who didn't take very kindly to that, "and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning, and he does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him." There is no shred of truth in the devil. So even if he says something that's true, it's meant to be a lie. It's used to lie to you somehow. People can tell you true things, but their heart can be lying because they're controlling and they're reducing the amount of information that's true down to something that will lead you to a conclusion that you wouldn't come to if you had all the information. There's no truth in the devil. He has no interest in telling you the truth. None. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. If I called you, somebody in this room, the father of cheating or the mother of stealing, I'm insulting you to the highest level. I am saying you're the original. You are the master of cheating and lying and stealing. Everybody else is but a learner, a student, an apprentice under you, because you're the master of it. You came up with it. You're the original liar. That's essentially what Jesus is saying about the devil. And he's saying to these Jews, you are of your father, the devil. You are his children. You're a chip off the old block. You learned well from your father. And there's no truth in him, and there's no truth in you. And then he goes on to say something quite astonishing. He said, but because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Now just think about that phrase for a minute. Because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. Now we're used to it being the other way around. Well, because you're lying to me, I don't believe you. Remember the little boy who cried wolf too many times? And he kept crying wolf, and there was really no wolf, and all the town came running out to find out, what, the wolf, come save the boy from the wolf. Oh, there's no wolf, and he laughs, and they all walk away. And finally, a real wolf comes by, and he cries wolf, and nobody comes. And the reason they don't come is because they don't believe him. And the reason they don't believe him is because he's been a liar. And Jesus turns this completely around, and he says, because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. He's basically saying, you're so committed to lies. You like the lie. You enjoy lying. You want a lie to be true. And then when I come and speak to you the truth, you're so hostile toward it. It's so against what you want to be reality that you don't believe me. If I speak the truth, why do you not believe me? He says. He who is of God hears the words of God. For this reason, you do not hear them, because you are not of God. Someone who's not of God doesn't want to hear the truth. Tell them the truth, it won't make any difference. They'll just be opposed to it. They'll think you're lying. They will disbelieve you. Why? Because they're not of God. They're not of the truth. They are of their father, the devil, and they want to believe a lie. Okay, the situation of the schools. If the devil is a liar, and if I'm right, that it is simply common sense, that it is simply logical for him to take control of the information centers and of the teachers so that he might deceive the masses. If I'm correct on that, then he's in the schools. And he has been for some time. Children are vulnerable. So are adults, but children more so. And they are gullible, and they are easy to deceive. If I had raised my kids and told them that Buddha was God, they would believe me. If I had told them with conviction, and I never said that Jesus Christ is God the Son, and I never explained to them the Trinity, and I never gone through them with a true Christian catechism and tried to teach them the truth from the Bible, but had instead taught them Buddhist teachings, they believe it. Because I said it. And I said it with conviction. And if I said it with Islam, it would be the same way. There are little children over in other countries across the world, and they are imbibing what their parents are telling them. And they're taking it as gospel, as the truth. Because their parents say it with conviction. They tell them that's the way it is. Society reinforces it for them. And they accept it. If you can get access to the children, if you can get their ear, and if you can get an open mic, so to speak, with an audience full of children, you have got it made. Because they will believe what you tell them. At least up to a certain age. Many have said, and I don't know if Hitler said this, I think he might have, and I know that some false churches and false prophets have said this, give me your children up to age, whatever, 7, and I'll have them for life. They're very confident of this. If you deceive them at an early age, it's very hard to undeceive them later. Deceived children usually grow up to be deceived adults. And then for the devil, the future is more secure. The devil has lied about science in our schools. For one thing, he has taught evolution and said it is good science. Evolution was invented by Charles Darwin as a substitute for theism. Charles Darwin did not want to believe in the biblical God, and therefore he needed to come up with some sort of scientific way of explaining reality. And atheists are jumping on board. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, has said that Darwinism gave him a construct to be an intellectually satisfied atheist, which he would not have otherwise. If you didn't have Darwinism and this idea of natural selection and evolving from the soup, so to speak, then it's very difficult to be an atheist as you look around and you see design everywhere. But this foolish, silly doctrine of evolution has allowed people to reject God. Where is the proof of it? Where are the transitionary forms between one kind of life that has supposedly evolved into a more sophisticated kind of life? Where is it? Where is the change that we ever see with regard to mutations in beings that has ever produced one helpful change? Mutations are almost always negative. Where is the proof? We have examples such as Nebraska Man that was in the textbooks for years, claimed to be a proof of a transitionary form. This was a half-ape, half-man kind of person. Turns out it was a tooth from a pig, an extinct form of pig. But even after it was proven to be such, it was not removed from the textbooks. It was continued to be talked about. Then we have Haeckel's embryos, where Haeckel, who was a contemporary, contemporary of Charles Darwin, fabricated pictures and drawings of embryos. So he has an embryo of a chick, an embryo of a turtle, an embryo of a whatever, these different kinds of animals, and then an embryo of a human being, and his attempt is to line them up side by side and show that as they develop, they look the same. As they develop in embryonic form and progress to maturity, they look the same, proving, of course, that we are basically animals. The problem is, he fabricated them. They don't look alike at all. But did that stop the publishers from continuing to put them in the textbook year after year after year? No. The world is millions and billions of years old. Now, I know there are professing Christians who believe this as well. But this is all based on an assumption that the fossil record is uniform. That there's a state of uniform decay. That you can study decay in a smaller unit of time and see how long does it take for this to develop. And then you can extrapolate over that and just to do simple math to calculate how old or how long it took to do this. There are multiple instances of this sort of logic being overthrown. At Mount St. Helens, for one, with stalactites coming in caves that have happened quite quickly, even though they've tried to measure the dripping and see how long it would take for this stalactite to form. And time after time, there's been other explanations reasonable to do this, but it's just dogmatically continued to be asserted that the world is millions and billions of years old and that the fossilization has happened in a uniform rate. But why must we assume it's been uniform? The consequences of these teachings are obvious, I think. If evolution and a multi-million-aged earth are true, then the Bible is not. The Bible teaches that the world was created in 6 days, morning and evening. The evolutionists understand that. And they rejoice at this, because they know it contradicts the Bible, and that's what they want it to do. And they want you to be so convinced that the world is that old and that the Bible teaches that it is in fact young, comparatively speaking, that one of these must be true and the other one is wrong. And so now we can't really trust the Bible. We can't really trust Genesis. And if we can't trust Genesis, what else can we not trust? If Genesis is not right, what else isn't right? And if Adam wasn't a real person, who else is a real person in the Bible? And if he's a myth and just some imaginary character, maybe Jesus is. And on it goes. Furthermore, if God didn't make you and you just evolved, you don't owe God anything. You're not obligated to God. There is no God. Furthermore, if you just came from the primordial slime, what is this ethics we keep talking about and morals? Who says it's right to do this and wrong to do that? Who says? God? There's no God. So if you just want to go out and have sexual relations with whomever you want, go for it. The animals do. They sleep around and you're just an animal. Oh, you want to be self-righteous and you want to be holy and be committed to one person in marriage for life. That's fine. Where'd you get that idea? Oh, the Bible? Well, you know about that. Don't think that the doctrine of evolution that has been so thoroughly dogmatically taught and our decay in morals are unrelated. They're not unrelated. A child doesn't necessarily have to be able to connect the dots for them to follow the ramifications of a certain teaching. They don't have to sit there and analyze this and think through, now if evolution is true, it means that God really isn't there, and if that's the case, then I can do whatever I want. They don't have to think that logically through to get there. Things can work at the subconscious level. If God didn't make you, then you don't owe Him anything. If the world was not made by God, then there's no meaning in life. What are we doing here? Why do you talk to anybody? Why do you, the things that you think are important, why? Why do they matter? If you're just a sophisticated tadpole, what matters? Why does your job matter? Why does your family matter? Why does anything matter? It doesn't. Who says it matters? Upon what authority can you state anything to be true or meaningful? If you came and watched the video a couple of Sundays ago, you'll remember Will Provine, the atheist, who said evolution was the key for his atheism. And he flat out said, there is no meaning to life, and there is no foundation for ethics and morals. There is no life after death, you're just done. And if his brain tumor comes back, which we found out from the video that it did, he said he's just going to shoot himself in the head. Because there is no foundation for morals. What's wrong with shooting yourself in the head? What's wrong with just not wanting to suffer? The evolution is true, he's right. He might as well go shoot himself in the head, because what does it matter? Who cares? If you evolve from a monkey, then you're just an animal, and acting like an animal and mating like an animal is no big deal. Truth is an invention, and it's relative. You know, Darwin himself said in The Origin of Species that if it could be shown that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have come into being by many gradual changes, then his theory would fail utterly. Well, we've got news for Darwin. We found complex organisms that could not have come into being through gradual successive changes. Try the cell, for one thing. I'd recommend to you a book called, a video called Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, which they go in and they talk about irreducible complexity. They say that when you study the cell, there's all these various components, like an engine. It's compared to an engine, and it has a rotor and a stator and a drive shaft and a motor and all these sorts of things. And if evolution were true, then all those various components would have had to have been added gradually throughout time. And since without the total package being present at once, none of them are of any benefit to the organism. And so why add them? And once you've added them, why keep them? Because you have to have all of them together for the thing to work. And so it simply cannot be explained by evolution. And so Darwin, by his own words, his theory is worthless. The devil has also chosen to lie about history. We do this through historical revisionism, whereby we're taught in school certain things about an historical event that simply aren't true. They're reshaped and reinterpreted. And you get this distilled, processed version of history that isn't the way it happened. A video that you could watch upon this would be David Barton's America's Godly Heritage. And he goes in and he quotes founding fathers and various things, and he shows how such information has been systematically removed from history courses and history books. Flat out lies about what happened. Another example of this would be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's looked at as a hero in history, and the one who saved us from the Great Depression. You might want to read Amity Schley's book, The Forgotten Man, which shows that because of FDR, the Great Depression was actually lengthened year after year after year, and for us lasted about 12 years, where the rest of the world, it lasted about 2. Because he kept tinkering and tinkering and tinkering and changing this and changing that and fiddling with this and massaging with that, that businesses didn't know what he was going to do next and hung on to their money and kept it tight for fear of what is he going to do next. Do you hear that in your American history courses? I don't think so. I didn't. George Washington, books come out condemning him or criticizing him or casting aspersions on him. Why? Because he was godly. One favorite example is, well, he stalled. Yes, he didn't take a salary in the Continental Army. And they want to throw aspersions on that, so they say, well, looky here, he spent $12,000 to stall his horse for one night. But what they don't tell you is that those were Continental dollars and practically worthless. So it was like stalling your horse for a few cents. Oh, didn't mention that. That's an example of what kinds of things go on. The separation of church and state. That's unconstitutional. We believe in separation of church and state. Folks, the separation of church and state is not found in the Constitution. The alleged claim that that's found in the First Amendment, listen carefully, this is the First Amendment. Here's the First Amendment of our Constitution. Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's it? Did you hear anything about separation of church and state? Did those words come up? No. Those words are found in a letter from Thomas Jefferson to a Baptist minister trying to assure him that the government's not going to rule the church. But today it's completely twisted around to try to keep any influence of the church toward the government, and particularly the schools, from ever happening. That was not Thomas Jefferson's concern. And the phrase isn't in the Constitution. The government, Congress specifically, shall not make a law respecting an establishment of religion. And back then, this is where we need to know our history as well, because words that we use now don't mean the same thing as words that meant then. We're talking about this in a Bible study a few weeks ago. The word meat in the King James simply means food. It doesn't mean literally meat as opposed to vegetables. It can mean that, but they use the word meat, sit down to meat, to just talk about food. But that's not the way we speak today, so we have to understand the changes in our own language. And back then, the word religion simply meant denominations. They weren't talking about Buddhism or Islam or things like that. It didn't occur to them that we would be establishing those kinds of religion in our country. What they didn't want was the King of England butting into the affairs of the church and deciding which denomination is the legitimate one for our country and which one isn't. That's what they were fleeing from. But we don't hear these kinds of explanations in history courses in our schools. There is simply the omission of important truths and events. Do you realize when you sit in a history course, you are getting someone's opinion on what is merits, time, and study in a history course? Every day of your life is history. Every day that you lived is history. Someone is going to decide in your lifetime what merits going into a book for future generations to study. It is highly subjective. It is someone's opinion of what ought to be studied and not studied. Now, what if that person who decides, who sits at the top and gets to decide what goes in the textbook, what if that person is ungodly? Do they care about the things God cares about? No. And they are of their father, the devil, a liar. You think the devil's just going to leave history textbooks alone? You think he wants things in history textbooks about the things that matter to God? Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want, in this day and age, the Bible being taught in schools unless it is being taught by a person who loves God and knows the Scriptures and how to interpret them. Because otherwise, it'll simply be mangled. But think for a minute. We're here on this earth for a very short time. And then we're dead, and then we stand before God. What matters to Him? What from history ought we to learn about and ought we to focus on? Is that worthy of consideration or isn't it? Are the people that put our textbooks together thinking about that sort of thing? Do they care what's important to God? So you're going to be required to memorize a bunch of worthless information. Worthless in God's eyes. Not saying everything's worthless, but I'm saying a lot of things would be. There would be then an overemphasis on things that are not important. Just watch the nightly news and you'll get a microcosm of this. Every night on the news, they have to pick, what are we going to put on here and what are we not going to put on here? They don't have time to cover everything. So they're going to pick. What criteria are they going to use to pick? They got 30 minutes on television for their news spot. At least some news channels, others have news all the time, other whatever. In any case, however long their news segment is, they're going to have to pick. They're going to have to shrink all that happened that day in the world down to a few things that they feel are important to tell you. What criteria will they use? Well, you see the same issue then with respect to history courses. They will choose according to what is important to them and what they want you to know. And if the devil is in charge of that, he's going to want you to know certain things and not know other things. When Christianity is dealt with at all, oftentimes in history fashion, it is dealt with where you mention the positives of other religions, the so-called positives and the so-called negatives of Christianity. If you bring up a Christian at all, a dedicated Christian, you'll find some sort of black spot in his life and you'll focus on that to the exclusion of all the good things he or she did. Other religions, if they are studied, it will be in a multicultural, pluralistic sort of way where they're interpreted to be equally valid because, of course, the First Amendment says we shall not have any law respecting the establishment of religion. And therefore, we can't favor any religion over another, forgetting that that meant denomination. And therefore, Buddhism is equally valid to Islam, which is equally valid to Hinduism, which is equally valid to Christianity. Well, Christianity kind of stinks, but the rest of them are pretty good. The devil lies through literature. Take the book, The Scarlet Letter. What is The Scarlet Letter designed to convince you of? What is the aim of the author? Is it not to convince you that Christians are puritanical? And the Puritans are to be painted as these obsessed, busybodies who pry into other people's affairs, literally, and want to get into your bedroom and see what you're doing there and manage your love life. And so they're cruel, wicked people who are self-righteous and sanctimonious. Isn't that the attempt, is to convince you that that's what all religious people are like? And that Hester, who had an affair with the minister, I wonder why it was a minister. And that she's really to be pitied and sympathized with. When and if they deal with sinners in the hands of an angry God, is it not to convince you that this is the sort of rotten, deplorable, hellfire and brimstone preaching that we have with Christians back in those days? Forget that it is a great sermon. It's an awesome sermon. Many people were converted by it. Are you going to get that? No, you're going to get, see here how he uses all these images to manipulate people and scare them out of hell. That'll be the sort of slant that you'll get if you study the sermon at all in literature class. The devil lies, of course, through sex education. First of all, that should even be taught by teachers and not at home by parents. That should even be discussed in school, period. Secondly, sexual urges are okay, they're even good. After all, after all, if you connect it with evolution, we're just sophisticated animals, and they go around and sleep everywhere. The important thing is to be safe. And of course, you're a nerd if you're a virgin. Well, I've got news for you. Immorality is not safe. If you are immoral, you are under the wrath of God. It doesn't matter if you don't get AIDS. You're under the wrath of God. You've got something worse than AIDS. You've got the curse of God upon you. You may be free of a disease. You may live till you're 90. But if there is no repentance, you will burn in hell if you are immoral. Is that taught? I doubt it. So, here, have some birth control pills and some other accessories. Go have some fun. Just be safe. The devil, of course, lies about priorities, not necessarily through the teaching arm of the education system, but simply through the groupthink that occurs. When you amass together a group of ungodly people, the sort of mentality that permeates the atmosphere has a powerful effect upon each individual, such that you learn things that are not openly taught. They're just modeled. For instance, sports is everything. The truth is, it's just a game. It's just a game. Your team may stink this year. It's okay. It's a game. Maybe you win the championship. Big deal. It's a game. But is that what you learn? Do you learn that it's just a game? No, you learn, this is serious. This is everything, people. We've got to win. And if we don't, what? You learn that being thin and beautiful is what matters. And if you're not those, you're nothing. That's learned. Without anybody saying a word and teaching it, it is learned. Why do you think girls become anorexic? Because they're learning. But if you're a little chubby, you're nothing. You're no good. Being fashionable is what matters. May change tomorrow, but you need to be fashionable today and then find out what's fashionable tomorrow. And when that becomes uncool, by all means, get rid of your closet and get a whole new wardrobe. Because we cannot be unfashionable. And just save it for 20 years because then it will be fashionable again. And we can wear bell bottoms again. Go around and tear holes in our kneecaps or something because that'll be cool one day again. This is the sort of things that we learn. We learn it's okay to dress like a whore because everyone's doing it. Clothes that are worn today, you would be viewed as a prostitute many years ago. That's not just fashionable. That's ungodly. But the devil would not have you think it's ungodly. He would have you think it's normal and okay and it's fine. After all, the girls like to be seen and the boys like to see them. They want to be watched and the boys are happy to watch. The devil, of course, also uses the government. Oh, I could probably go on and on with education. And at the college level, it's like all restraints are thrown off. There's not even a veneer of restraint or conservative thinking at all at the college level. If and when you go to college, you are in a nest of ungodly liberal vipers who are smarter than you are and they talk better than you do. And woe be to you if you try to disagree with them and be different than the politically correct established idea of what you're supposed to be. It is a bastion for these sorts of things. I just want to briefly cover the issue of governing authorities and the way the devil uses government. Clearly, as we look back in 1 Peter 5, this is one of the issues and of the day where the Roman Empire, of course, was controlled in one sense, by the evil one, and God controls him, but we're not operating on the highest level when we're dealing with this, on what God's purposes are in all these things. We're coming down a level, and we're just looking at the evil ones and what he does. He works through authorities. I did not give you an insert this morning, but I have a few verses here to read. First one is Daniel 10, 12 through 13, and also verses 20 through 21. Daniel 10, verses 12 through 13, and 20 through 21. Daniel is praying. He's been praying and fasting for 3 weeks. And finally, an angel arrives to give him an answer to his prayer. And here's what the angel says. Then he said to me, "Do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia." Indicating that the authorities on earth and evil authorities in the heavenly places are somehow connected with one another. In this case, we have a prince over Persia. Persia was an evil empire, an ungodly one. And there's a prince. And it would have to be a demonic being to be able to resist an angel for 21 days. And then there's these other ones called the kings of Persia. And he was left there with them. And there was no one to help him but Michael. We read about in other places that that's the archangel Michael. So there is this war going on in the heavenly places between angels, good ones, and fallen angels, often called the authorities or the rulers in heavenly places. In verses 20 through 21 of the same chapter, "Then he said, 'Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come.'" And what we know in history, in biblical history, is that Persia rose up as an empire. The Medes and the Persians kind of together, and then it became the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Greek Empire, whereby Alexander the Great went around conquering everywhere he went and spread the Greek language throughout the world, which is why the New Testament was written in Greek, and why during the intertestamental period, the Old Testament Hebrew was translated by 70 scholars into what we call the Septuagint, where the Hebrew was translated into Greek. The reason being, because Greek was spread all over the place. That's why the New Testament was written in Greek. And here we hear about the Prince of Greece is about to come. Probably connecting an evil demon that was somehow working with and empowering Alexander the Great. "However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince." In Ephesians 6, which we looked at during the series that I preached on spiritual warfare, it says this, "Finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places." This is why Jesus said, "I saw Satan fall like a star from heaven." They're in the heavenly places. They're not in hell. Not yet. They're in the heavenly places. They're above. Ephesians 3, 8 through 10. Paul talks about being given the mystery to preach to the Gentiles, which for ages has been hidden in God who created all things, so that the manifold wisdom of God might be made known through the church to the rulers and the authorities in the heavenly places. Part of the church's ministry is to make known through the church the manifold wisdom of God to these rulers. Romans 8, 38 through 39, "I'm convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels nor principalities, nor things present nor things to come will be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ." Colossians 2, 13 through 15, talking about Christ's work on the cross and how He canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and He has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross, when He had disarmed the rulers and authorities He made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. So the rulers and authorities could connect perhaps people like Pilate and Herod and Caesar and so on with the demonic principalities that rule over them. So let us not be surprised if Satan works through government and if he works through ours. Our government is probably a little bit harder to corrupt than a dictatorship is. A dictatorship, all you need to do is corrupt one man who controls everyone else, who calls all the shots. In our country, you have to corrupt all these representatives, all these senators, the Supreme Court, and a president. And it appears that he's accomplished that pretty well. What they do will affect everyone else. The laws they pass will affect the citizens. And just as the same logic that we spoke of, which applies to controlling the information centers, so Satan is wise if he controls the power centers. If he controls those who have power, if he controls those who have power over the information. So it should not surprise us if persecution comes and if difficulties are coming down the pike for us. Because Satan is active, he is real, he goes around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, and he is involved with the authorities and with the governing rulers. And his desire is to devour people. And if he can get a hold of the government so that he can use them as a persecuting arm against the church, then perhaps he can get a bunch of people who have professed faith in Jesus Christ to abandon their faith in Jesus Christ and apostatize, thereby bringing reproach upon Christianity. And perhaps he can get other true Christians to temporarily deny their faith, as he did Peter, also bringing reproach upon Christ. And so as Peter tells us, be alert, be on guard. Do not fall asleep with respect to the devil. This is war. And you will be in warfare until you die. And if you're not engaged in the battle, you're missing in action. You're AWOL. Pray. Father, if we move on now to other subjects in future weeks, it's going to be easy, in fact, maybe customary, to forget what we discussed here. We need your help to seal this truth to our hearts, to remember these things, and to stay alert. We don't have a very good track record, and we beg for your grace. Make us alert.